Everybody come by the floor. Guys, I like you on the short side.
Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. It's another Saturday here in the T Dot, and we are live in studio like we do every Saturday. And I am Jams. Joining me in studio, almost the whole collective.
Mally, aka Docu Vixen.
Luam.
AKA L Boogie, AKA L.
AKA a lot. I think maybe that can be the thing. It's like each week I'll just be a different AKA. Yeah. There we go. Because Luam, that's it. It's like and
Luam.
Luam, AKA Luam.
Yeah. Okay.
And we also have
Adrian, AKA Adrian Worrell, AKA. Who am I?
Griffin. Gonna?
That's right. Yes.
Oh wow. A little existential.
Yeah, it's been one of those weeks. Yeah.
And of course, we have also
Kemba King, aka Meme.
And we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization, identity.
Oh, yes, my cue.
Your cue, your line.
My line. It's a mass culture, personality based mass culture studies.
And we talk about love and resistance.
Yep.
Environmental racism and environmental justice.
That's it, y'all. And also arts.
And storytelling.
And imagination.
Yeah, that's it. That's what we do every Saturday. And then from 4 to 5, the DJs, being Griffin.
That's me.
And myself, Jams, bringing music to move you, which we will be doing later on in the show. Today, we are going to be speaking with Frances Ann Solomon, who is a longtime friend of the Vibe Collective. She's been on the show many times. We love her dearly. She is a filmmaker, an incredible filmmaker, and the founder of Caribbean Tales Film Festival, which is taking place right now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, we if people don't know, I've been involved with the festival for two and a half years, and this year I'm the associate director. Which is exciting. It's exciting.
It's very exciting.
And we actually opened at the CNE on August 17th. We kind of expanded into August, so that was exciting. We partnered with the Islands of the Caribbean. There's six islands, I believe: Jamaica, St. Vincent, St. Lucia. I can't think of the other ones. Antigua, Barbuda, and Grenada. Did I say Grenada?
Nope.
I think that's six. Anyway, so we have one more date at the CNE, and that's going to be on the 30th, and the focus is St. Vincent and St. Lucia, and we're going to have a panel of filmmakers, and we're going to show shorts from those two islands, and then we're screening Home Again.
Well, why don't we get to Frances Ann, because we do have her on the line, and I'd like to welcome her back to the Vibe Collective. Welcome, Frances Ann.
Hi, Demayas. Hi, Mally. Hi, everybody.
Peace.
It's good to have you back on the show, Frances Anne. Thanks. And once again, pulling off this magic, you and Melinda, the way you guys do this is just, it's incredible. So do you want to talk a little bit about, first of all, is this your seventh year?
It's the eighth year.
The eighth year, oh my goodness.
For the festival, yeah.
Eighth year. And as Melinda was saying, you're featuring quite a few islands from the Caribbean. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's wonderful. We were approached by a group called the Islands of the Caribbean, which is actually an association of tourism boards of six islands. So Jamaica, Antigua, Barbuda, Grenada, St. Vincent, St. Lucia, and St. Kitts.
Oh, I miss St. Kitts.
Yeah. And what's significant about that for me, actually, is that the relationship between tourism and filmmaking has not necessarily been but it's not been an obvious relationship, because tourism's mandate traditionally has been sun, sand, and sea. And as filmmakers, we often, first of all, filmmaking itself is quite new in the region, and so there were always questions about whether we were good enough, you know, whether we were going to make good enough films. And then the question was the content of what we were going to be making going to be suitable, going to scare tourists off, you know? Was it going to be suitable for promoting sun, sand, and sea, or was it going to scare tourists off? And I think it's a testament to both the quality of the work that's coming out of the region, one, as well as a growing kind of respect for authentic storytelling from the region, that we were actually approached by the tourism boards this year. It's really, really significant for me, because I've always thought that it was a natural match, that they were promoting the Caribbean, we were promoting the Caribbean, so we should get together and do it together. And that's tourism is also the major industry in the region. So the fact that we were approached by them to, in a way, present a showcase of our product for them, you know, for their benefit, it's just huge for us, and we're just very, very grateful for the partnership and looking forward to much more. And it's been really, really a fun ride, very, very successful. We, like I said, like Molly said, they took us down this year at the CNE, and there's a cinema down there, the presentation cinema, and so we were able to present Caribbean work there.
It's interesting to hear about the position between the tourism boards and the filmmakers, and the two different, the contrast of the two stories of the Caribbean that each are trying to present. Can you talk a little bit about some of those films and you know, what people can look forward to if they make it down to
the CNE.
The film festival? Yeah.
But to the CNE specifically? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well, it's been an interesting, like, obviously there's give and take between us and the islands, but it's been one that I've kind of enjoyed, because really I worked with each one of the representatives of each of those areas to come up with a program that would meet their mandate as well as our mandate. So their mandate is, you know, promoting the Caribbean as destinations in order to build the economy of the region. And our mandate is to tell authentic stories, you know, to reflect authentic storytelling by, for, and about Caribbean people. So on the first day was Jamaica, and we showed Marley. We also showed, you know, the biopic about Bob, which is really extraordinary, really. And we also showed short films by a number of Jamaican filmmakers, so that was great. And then the second day we showed was Antigua, Barbuda, and Grenada. And it was really interesting, actually, because the director of tourism for Toronto, for Antigua, Erica, she is really quite amazing, I think. And she selected a number. Together, we selected a number of filmmakers that we wanted to promote from Antigua. One was James Knight, who produced a film about Short Shirt, a Calypsonian, the first film about a Calypsonian made in Antigua. And the other one was a film called Ariana by a filmmaker called Shashi Baluja, who's based in New York. And it's a very, very, out gay film. And I had to say to her, I said, are you okay with showing this wig? It was actually her suggestion. Are you okay with this stamp of the Antigua Tourism Board being on a very, you know, out gay film? It wasn't even about coming out. It was about a relationship that was in the throes of being itself. And, you know, and she said, no, it's about love, you know, and I believe that is what comes from. We are completely fine with supporting. And that was so great for me to hear, because we, over the last 3 years, have had a commitment to having a queer Caribbean showcase in order to bring LGBT work by Caribbean artists into the mainstream of Caribbean culture. You know, because the Caribbean is known to be a very, very homophobic society, and it has been a struggle, it was really great for me to have that support from the Tourism Board of Antigua. And then the final screening that we're having on the 30th at the CNE is going to be St. Vincent and the Grenadines and St. Lucia, and we are also going to have a panel of a roundtable of Caribbean filmmakers discussing both Canadian-based and regional-based to talk about that global industry and how it's emerging and developing, as well as showing short films by a number of filmmakers from that region, including a preview of a new film about the poet laureate Derek Walcott, who, of course, is St. Lucia.
Can you talk a little bit more about what your process for selecting the films are?
Well, we have a selection committee, and really the mandate is to pick those stories that contribute to an understanding of or dialogue about who we are as Caribbean people in the region and the diaspora. That's really the mandate. And so, you know, it's really about who we are when we are being ourselves, and also how do we do that best, and to choose the best films that do that. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're not looking for work that competes with Hollywood. We're not looking for work that pretends to be anything but itself, and that does that in the most authentic way.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of discussions that we have as a selection committee. You know, and it's an ongoing dialogue, because the industry, our emerging industry, is new. And so I think the kind of rigorous discussion that we have, you know, deserves to be translated across the region, in terms of, it's a new dialogue. Who are we, and how do we tell those stories, especially as we are so diverse, both across islands, across languages. There's French, Dutch, English, many types of Creole, Spanish. Which parts of the Caribbean qualify as the Caribbean? What stories? This is a really thorny issue. What is Caribbean? And then making that as broad as possible, while always insisting upon authenticity. And then the question is, well, what is authentic? You know.
And that's kind of what I was gonna follow up with, is thinking through the partnership with the tourism boards. I guess this is a twofold question. The first one is this a multi-year partnership, or is it a partnership that you're going to be negotiating on a year-by-year basis? And the reason I'm asking that is I'm wondering if this is the first time that the two mandates have had to work together in order to think about the types of films that you're going to be bringing. I wonder if you continue to partner with the tourism boards, one, what type of films you'll be attracting in terms of potential submissions or people reaching out to you, and then also how the notion of identity of what the Caribbean is will be affected. Because part of it being an economic industry is also then tied with the histories of colonialism and the ways in which the land grabs, both in the Caribbean by French and German nationals, among many others, has affected the ways in which the stories of the Caribbean get told. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe touch base on both those things.
Well, look, yes, absolutely. I think that this is not the only partnership we have, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that, you know, just to say that this is a small part of what we do. But it's a new partnership that I think is headed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And of course it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, you know, a honeymoon. Mm-hmm. We had to negotiate some boundaries. And honestly, for me, it was like, you know, we have lots of outlets for showing the work that we want to show. So this is one. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, the important thing is to find common ground and to build a relationship that hopefully is sustainable. But we don't know. I think it's an experiment for them as well. You know, so we'll see. I'm sure that the that individual relationships will grow and continue between, you know, individual. And it's actually not the first time. We did also work with the Caribbean Tourism Organization. We had a festival for a couple of years in New York, but which was during Caribbean Week, when they have their Caribbean Week in New York. And they were, you know, they were keen for us to do our stuff with them. And they do recognize the value and power of film as a medium to support their aims. It's constantly being renegotiated, you know. And yeah, there are whole areas of discussion that just don't fit into that dialogue, you know.
I was wondering to the extent to which Caribbean regional integration is affecting the way that stories are being told there now, or how you're seeing it reflected in film, if at all.
Not really, because still I think that the individual identities, you know, we have carved such different, modes of expression across islands, which are the size of peas, okay? But there is a body of water separating them, which has created a lot of, you know, huge kind of inward-lookingness in each island. So each island, each territory is separated by language, is separated by water, and it's impossible to cross that. It costs $400 on Liat to get from one island to another, which is exactly less than it costs to come to Canada, practically. So it's very, you know, the islands have very separate identities, regardless of integration. And now I think filmmakers and art, you know, crossing and going to each other's festivals and stuff. And we encourage that cross-fertilization, but we also encourage, again, that authenticity in language, in storytelling, in just faithfulness, you know, to their own truth. You know, so if that's what it is, and it is divided, there is very separate audiences. It's not just in terms of expression, it's also in terms of audiences. Like, Bajans will go and see Bajan films, Bajan stories. You know, they won't go and see a Jamaican film. And Jamaicans will go and see. So, like, when we are trying to sell these stories here in Caribbean Tales, you know, for better or worse, we have to say, okay, this is a Trini story. We have to go after the Trini audiences because they're the ones who are going to come. And then we get some crossover, obviously. This is a Jamaican film. We have to get that Jamaican core audience. And then when you see the people turn up, you know, a Jamaican film, 90% of the audience, 95% of the audience is Jamaican, and the same thing for each and every one of the islands. So that is their core audience, for better or for worse. And of course, we project a brand which is not just regional, but actually includes the diaspora, right? Our brand is Caribbean Tales, and it's Caribbean Tales worldwide. So it's all those communities, you know, across the diaspora, America, Canada, England, Europe, you know, who are of Caribbean heritage. And, you know, theoretically, it's also everywhere the Caribbean people come from: Africa, India, Lebanon, China, you know. Those are our audiences, theoretically, but bridging that and creating, you know, means targeting the individual populations first and then growing the noise, you know. Like if a Canadian film, you know, manages to attract enough of its own home audience, it's like, then, you know, people in in Trinidad start talking about it and wanting to see it. And it's that principle of, you know, starting local and going global from there.
I see. But also there's been a kind of like inter-Caribbean immigration where you have, for example, I think it's Jamaican people in Barbados and people from St. Vincent going to other islands as well. So you've had like a lot of kind of, particularly in the last 10 years, a lot of kind of inter-Caribbean immigration. And I was wondering to extent like how that is affecting some of the stories that are being told in the storytelling traditions.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And not just in the last 10 years. I mean, all of us, a lot of us from Trinidad have relatives who were from Grenada during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And, you know, many of us, myself included, our ancestors came from Barbados to Trinidad in the latter part of the 19th century. And so inter-island, you know, a lot of people from Barbados also went to help build the Panama Canal. I mean, those stories are endless of inter-regional, you know, migration. So absolutely, I mean, I think that's very rich in terms of the possibilities for storytelling. I haven't seen too many of them to date, but I think that's definitely a rich vein, you know.
There's actually a film that's going to be screened called Diary of the Immigrant, and it's actually a short film about, I think she's Guyanese, character, yeah, so living in Barbados. So there is, like, stories that kind of touch on that as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that you were trying to create more of a connection with queer communities throughout the Caribbean and making sure that stories of queerness are represented in the selection of films that you're showing. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little more about how that came about in your discussion among your selection committee and what groups you're either thinking to partner with or potentially partnering with in order to make sure that queer people are represented in the stories of the Caribbean.
Okay, well, I mean, I decided that was a commitment that I wanted to make, given the homophobia in our community. I felt it was important to take a stand against it because it's really a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a problem that I don't think you can be silent about.
True.
But actually, once we made that decision, we decided we were going to have this showcase called Queer Caribbean, and we put it in our program. And you know, first of all, you know, the reaction in the first year of the mainstream Caribbean culture was pretty, you know, solid. We don't want to talk about that, for example, on this radio program type thing.
Mm.
You know, I'm going to interview you, but don't mention that.
Oh, okay.
And stuff like that. And then when we actually had the first screening, which was a screening of Campbell X's first movie,
Stud Life.
What was it called again?
Stud Life.
Stud Life, yeah. And a number of shorts along with it. The gay community actually did not come out to a lot in large numbers. And I think, again, that was because, you know, there's a lot of separation between the so-called mainstream of our culture and the LGBT Caribbean LGBT community.
And issues around safety as well and going and potentially being outed to family or communities that don't necessarily know.
That's right.
Yeah.
But this year we kind of confronted the fact that it wasn't enough to just program it. We actually had to do a lot of outreach. And so that's what we've been doing. We've partnered with Proud FM and a number of other LGBT organizations. And also we've engaged the filmmakers more because last year Campbell wasn't able to come. And the other film that we showed, which was a short film by Alison Duke. Alison wasn't in town then.
Okay.
And stated, she wasn't in town. So this year, like I said, one of the films that we're showing is Ariana by Shashi Baluja. And Shashi is very much, he has been, you know, putting out press releases and promoting it heavily. But as I said, also, the Antigua government has engaged in doing a lot of promotional work around the film. And then we have done a lot of outreach. And so actually at the moment, it's our most sold out program. Okay. Not sold out, but it's all. We've sold more tickets for that program, which is great, you know. And to be honest, the reaction is definitely this year, I think, because history is beginning to catch up with these attitudes, you mm-hmm. know. We didn't get the kind of don't talk about that. We got kind of silence, you know. So.
Which is an improvement.
It is an improvement,
small,
yeah.
Small steps. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's definitely an improvement, even though, yeah, it's still difficult to say it. It's still difficult for me to stand up, or for any of us to stand up in front of an audience of Caribbean people and say Caribbean Tales has a commitment to representing the work of LGBT filmmakers of Caribbean heritage, because we stand against homophobia in our communities. It's still difficult to say that, but we don't, you know, and to actually kind of experience the silence that happens when you do say it. But I just am convinced that by next year it will be different and it will only get better.
Can you talk a little bit before we wrap up, Frances Anne, can you talk about the different, I noticed that you've got a lot of community screenings happening this year. You've got some happening at Regent Park and at York Woods. Can you talk a little bit about that and also about Caribbean Tales TV?
And don't forget Harbourfront.
Of course, and Harbourfront, yes.
At Harbourfront. Anyway, in terms of the community screenings, that was... Well, Caribbean Tales has a commitment to bringing work by regional and diaspora filmmakers of Caribbean heritage to priority areas in Canada, because I really strongly believe that it's by knowing that youth in Canada who have grown up in Canada, that it helps them to have a sense of the larger culture of where they come from and the power and strength and dynamism of that. I think it's transformative for young people to understand that they come from this extraordinary richness. And I've seen it happen so many times, you know, with young people. And so for many years now, we've had the Caribbean Tales Youth Film Festival in order to take films from the Caribbean and to the communities of heritage in priority areas and give youth an opportunity to engage with and dialogue about their heritage cultures. And so that work was already done by Molly. She's the one who organized those screenings and is in charge of that outreach work this year. Thank you, Molly.
No problem. Yeah, so there's going to be two screenings. Maybe we should actually talk about the gala and like the launch of the festival. And then maybe a little, TV, because that's launching. And maybe a little bit about the incubator, because we're not just a festival. We're like kind of a support place for filmmakers. Yeah.
Okay, so the gala. Okay, we have Harbourfront Centre has been our home for the last 4 years. So we have 10 days of screenings at the Harbourfront Centre, starting with the gala on the 4th. An extraordinary film by Christopher Laird called No Bomber, No Fraid, about two internationally certified karate experts, black belts, who decide to take those skills and that understanding of martial arts and discipline, for men, and to take that in back home, and to they went and explored and found the ancient art of Kalinda, which came from the Congo, known as stick fighting. And they started what's called a Bois Academy. They trained at the feet of the Kalinda masters, and the film is about that journey for them of kind of bringing themselves back to their roots and submitting themselves to that training and building this foundation. It's an extraordinary film. And I think, again, it's very, very useful for young people in Canada to see those, how strong, you know, that kind of power, you know, it's good training for men. So there's that. And then we have all kinds of films from Aruba, from Haiti, from Barbados. We have Bajan Invasion 2, very strong feature films. We have an amazing film that we're closing with called Songs of Redemption, which is about a recording studio set up in Kingston Penitentiary, and the inmates get an opportunity to write and record this extraordinary music. We have Kingston Paradise, which is a new film, world premiere. It's actually a Caribbean Tales original production by Mary Wells. We have a Cuban film called El Medico, about a doctor trained in the Fidel Castro's communist regime who becomes a hip-hop artist. And we have Elliot Loves, which is part of our Queer Caribbean showcase. And a lot of other films. We have 55 films this year from all different parts and themes. That's the CareHub Showcase, the incubator program, of course, brings filmmakers from all around the Caribbean. It's part of our commitment to building an industry. We are not about showcasing films. We're about actually building capacity and infrastructure to make an industry that's sustainable, just like Hollywood, Bollywood, Nollywood, and any other film industry, and of harnessing that strength and building an industry alongside agriculture and tourism and stuff like that. And so we have this year 11 filmmakers from 7 different countries coming from to train with a number of international and local, as in Canadian, mentors in the all-important art skills of marketing and packaging their films. They're going to be comes ahead at a pitch breakfast that we have for TIFF delegates and international delegates from all over the world, where they'll get an opportunity to pitch their projects at the Bell Lightbox. And finally, Caribbean Tales TV launches this year, and it's our video on demand channel. We have 300 films that will be online from September the 12th, and until then, every Sunday, we have our first Caribbean Tales online film festival, where we'll be showing a number of films free of charge at CaribbeanTalesTV.com.
Yeah. Do we have any questions?
It's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And I think it's really cool, because, I mean, I think, you know, growing up as a young person in Canada, it would have been great to have that resource. So going forward, hopefully, you know, people will be able to use it to help them develop their personality and look at that place in through these different lenses.
Yeah, and stories of their identities and stories of place and the ways in which we create place as well, you know? Mm-hmm. And pop culture being a big part of that, and seeing reflections of yourself not only on screen, but also seeing reflections of yourself and who's writing these stories, who's producing them. So, like, the technical aspects of it are important as well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. So, Frances Anne, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome.
But also, I want to thank you for the work you've been doing for the Caribbean film community, because I know you and Melinda both work tirelessly on this festival, and I know you're doing it, you know, strictly for the love and creating a means of distribution for films that wouldn't otherwise be seen here in Canada. So thank you so much for this labor of love.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for what you do. It's great to meet you all, and I hope to see you at the festival.
Yes, definitely. We will. I'm sure you will see all of us at some point.
Well, I don't miss it.
Yeah, definitely. We will be there.
Thanks, Frances.
Okay. Thank you, Frances Anne.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
you
take care. So Frances Anne Solomon, Caribbean Tales Film Festival. You're listening to The Vibe Collective. We've got to go to an ad break, and then we'll be back for some freestyle vibes here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
CIUT invites you to experience the Guelph Jazz Festival's 20th anniversary, September 4th through the 8th. Celebrate a world of jazz with amazing performances by leading international artists from the USA, Brazil, Japan, France, Norway, Sweden, Turkey, South Korea, India, Morocco, and more. This year's festival offers a truly international groove with performances by the Scandinavian jazz group Atomic, joined by Norway's Muskus Trio. The spectacular double bill is on Wednesday, September 4th at the River Run Center's Cooperators Hall. The TD Late Night Series features Constellation Records indie chamber group Esmerine, Ottawa's World Fusion Heavyweights, the Soul Jazz Orchestra, and the up-and-coming post-bop instrumental hip-hop trio Bad Bad Not Good. Other performers include Nicole Mitchell and her Indigo Trio, Brooklyn-based Dawn of Midi, and many more. Tickets for individual shows as well as festival passes are on sale now at the River Run Center box office. Please visit GuelphJazzFestival.com for more information.
Hi, everyone. This is Ralph Ben-Murgi, and I have a new show here on CIUT. It's called The New Sabbath Project, and we'd love you to join us for conversations about all things related to culture, citizenship, community, spirituality, and religion. The New Sabbath Project here on CIUT 89.5, Sundays at 2 p.m.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we're back. Caught you all. We're back on the Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Jam.
What's good? I'm Luan.
I'm Kemba.
Adrian Worrell, a.k.a. Griffin.
Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen.
And we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. And then from 4 to 5, the music brings you DJs to move you.
That's a poem I remix. Like you're talking about that's the relationship. Right. I'm
just gonna say yeah, that. No, yes. Yeah. You got it. That's right. Exactly what I was doing. Yes, the poetry of music mixed by DJs.
Yes.
Yes. that's what we bring.
Every week.
In the 4 o'clock hour.
That would be an awesome show, actually.
The poetry of music?
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then mixing. And yeah, that would be good. Anyway.
Yeah.
We always going to ask if anyone can believe that Hulk Hogan lost to Mayor Ford.
That was so staged. Come on.
No way. Wait. What's on stage?
Yo, no. Back that train up. I missed it.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Hulk Hogan and Rob Ford?
Yeah. The fan expo is going on. What? If people know.
And Rob Ford won?
Yeah. That's so chased.
What?
Come on now. That was staged. Did you see it? I saw it.
No, I didn't know anything about this.
Yeah. I missed this too, Jen.
He was like, you know, Hulk Hogan, he's very like theatrical, right? Like, it was just like he was doing a bit, like it was, yeah. And then, like,
really,
and then Rob Ford wins and he jumps up, you know. And
hey, Ford,
Rob Ford can jump. Oh.
Stop,
that ain't right.
Sorry. I know that was wrong. Right.
Rob Ford was at one time a college athlete.
Yes.
Actually,
yes. He was in football. No,
yeah, he probably got his thugs to scare everybody off.
Allegedly,
his alleged thugs.
Thank you, man. I don't know how many lawsuits Kemba saved us from already.
Kemba's always our savior.
Oh, you know his people are listening.
Yeah.
What up, C-Sis?
What up? C-Sis.
That's how I answer my phone.
You know what? Like, if people really don't like us when we talk about Rob Ford, he does have a state. He has a show tomorrow.
Exactly.
Yeah. You can listen to that.
Yeah.
It's not that great.
We're
but,
the balance to his show.
Exactly.
So,
word up.
There you have it.
But you know, everyone makes fun, but if we, you know, when he gets elected out or whatever happens, we'll be like, you're gonna miss Ford, man, because like it's never a slow news week.
That's true, but I don't know. I'm okay with a slow news week.
And we always have something to talk about here.
Yeah, that's true.
Like celebrity gossip. Like North made an appearance.
What?
Who?
What? Northwest.
No, Northwest. Kanye.
Oh,
and Kim's, baby.
Right.
Ray J's a goddaddy.
Oh, gosh.
Ray J.
Okay.
Oh. This is the third week in a row that Ray J's come up. Something's off.
Yeah, I missed last week. I wasn't here for that.
It's because the week before, Adrian had enlightened me to the fact that Ray J had a song called I Hit It First.
Right.
Because
right.
He's ever so classy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then we discussed that last week. And now this is the third week that we've somehow, of all of the Ray topics...
For AJ.
Wow.
But to that song, did he really have to do that? Because we already, like, the sex tape is out there. So it's like, everybody knows
it's
that.
Kind of, yeah.
Listen, misogyny knows no boundaries. You know, patriarchy will rear its head at any given opportunity. There's no subtlety about it. So.
Yeah, like.
So true.
Well, it's because Ray J doesn't really have a career.
That's also true.
So it's like that was the only thing to get
allegedly
anything.
Or we don't know exactly what Ray J's career is.
That's
maybe it's not really making music.
Maybe that's his career.
Just saying.
Oh, man. Okay, so what else is happening in celebrity gossip this week, Adrian?
I don't know. I've been slow this week. You know, I've been actually been somewhat productive writing. So I've not been able to, like, foss in people's business. Like,
how's your thesis coming?
It's pretty good. It's slowly killing me and taking most of my will to live. But other than that, it's going really well.
Have we talked about your thesis on the show before?
I don't know. What are you writing about with this?
Well, basically, it's about growing up under multiculturalism and how that promotes certain ideas of race and how that affects education inside of schooling and outside of schooling.
Is there a particular focus in terms of schooling, high school, elementary, or just generally speaking, the discourse of school?
Man, using those big school words.
Yeah.
I heard the word discourse. I'm like, you know,
people can't see you when you do that. You
tell them, like, this is why I think we also need a video cam thing.
No, yeah. Because it's going to take me an extra half hour to get ready to get here.
Wait, really?
Oh, Kemba.
Kemba hair's all crimp up and bleached. Dyed and like jewelry's matching the earrings. Like, more time?
Like, I can't. Like, it's true though, because you're always on point.
Oh, yeah. Please don't do this right now. It was a joke. It was a joke.
This is also okay. We could start the Kemba dating line later.
Oh. So your thesis.
Nice redirection. Don't sleep at all, man.
Inside jokes on the Vibe Collective, everybody.
Oh, man. Yeah, so it focuses on, like, schools as actual, you know, just kind of practices in elementary schools, high schools, like the kind of, like, some statistical type things around race. And also, like, hip-hop, because hip-hop claims to be a school in a sense, and how hip-hop is actually part of that or can be, not always, part of that miseducation complex. So, like, looking at how these different forces overlap to create a particular ideas of race that affect society.
Okay.
There was, like, this book that I read a long time ago, and I can't remember the name of the author because, you know, my brain is fried. He was Trinidadian. I think it was called The Cult of Multiculturalism. Mm. And I'm wondering, are you looking at multiculturalism from a very, like, a federal program? Or are you looking at it from a general understanding of multiculturalism?
Both. Okay. Yeah, both. Like, how the program, how it came about, like, the conditions that led to its being adopted. You know, because it's very much like the civil rights movement in a sense where Canada couldn't be seen as this kind of, like, global peacemaker, whatever image is trying to craft itself in, unless it kind of accepted immigrants and treated mm-hmm. them in a certain, made it look like they're treating them in a certain kind of way. Mm. That's the same way that, you know, to a extent that the civil rights movement, you know, 50 years now since the March on Washington, was able to, you know, kind of enfranchise this kind of class of people, you know, right. this protest culture. So, like, during this kind of Cold War tensions, like, how these states reacted to, if it's like independence movements in, you know, the quote-unquote third world, and how that was kind of mirrored or contained here, and how the education system was a huge part in that,
mm-hmm.
culturally and school.
It's interesting. I remember maybe a year ago going to a talk around Haiti independence and, like, notions of sovereignty and freedom in Black communities. And one of the speakers saying, you know, it's interesting that Canada's always pitted as this nation that's about peacekeeping. He's like, the only peacekeeping that Canada has ever done or will ever do is keep peace between imperialist nations. Mm-hmm. It's never concerned about the people on the ground or the people that are affected by occupation. It's right. about keeping peace between imperialist nations, and that's been the role of Canada mm-hmm. and continues to be so. And so it's interesting in terms of a nationalist project, the way that multiculturalism is deployed, both in the stories that you hear about Canada and the way that Canada talks about migration, mm-hmm. though it's interesting to see the shift away from that with the Harper administration. Though that it started to happen before, but the just blatant xenophobic, racist police state that is just being pushed at such an obvious and outright way at this point, you know.
But at the same time, there's this kind of an inclusionist faced on it, right? Like, I mean, there's a meme I saw this week on Facebook that just had me laughing, where it shows, like, Stephen Harper, he's dressed as a Sikh, he's dressed as, I can't remember, but he's dressed in all these kind of different multicultural kind of
dress
appealing to these groups, right? And it's kind of that sense where you have this kind of, like, two-facedness of Canadian policy and identity, like, where it's like, we're going to be, on one sense, repressive and building prisons for your kids. And on the other hand, we're going to show up and, sure, we'll eat a samosa and we'll do whatever.
That stuff drives me crazy. Mm-hmm.
But that's how imperialism functions generally. It's like you do have to kind of placate the locals in a certain kind of sense and make these kind of displays that make them
Some of the locals, though, it's a very select group, because then you also have the war on indigenous people that, you know, we're seeing through genocidal policies within the legislation that's been, you know, happening over the course of the last, in particular over the last 2 years, with major changes to the Indian Act, no mm-hmm. consultation, removing pretty much all environmental protection laws, and these FIPA agreements that Stephen Harper has been negotiating in secret, that are essentially packaging and parceling Canada off to different countries and different corporations, and allowing them to come in and develop without consulting for the ways in which this is affecting indigenous land that is protected by treaties.
I think multiculturalism is used for those communities to buy into that colonization.
And I think that we do, right? Because how many, I was going to say of us, but how many people, and I'll include myself, like, whose parents got here because of Trudeau? When I hear that, my head explodes every time, right? And I feel like First Nations and Indigenous communities draw the line in the sand, especially around Idle No More. You can't have Stephen Harper come to a meeting in a headdress, but he could come, like, in the dashiki to another meeting, and that kind of stuff. Like, we as communities of colors, as immigrant communities, have to be like, nah, you can't come like that. Come in your suit or your polo top, right? Like,
yeah.
I think we talked about this before, but I feel like we have to, like, say, you can come, but you can't. Putting on something that represents my culture is not going to make you feel more welcome.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It'll do, or I think we should just say, you don't come. Like, that's where I'm at.
Well, I'm trying to, like, progressively, like, because
okay, don't worry.
Not everyone.
I, you know what? I'll be the yin to the yang. I will say, Harper, stay out of my community. And I even censored.
But that's a big thing. I think we have to respect, like, this is what I'm learning about my father, right? My father is conservative, and I don't mean, like, he votes conservatively, but, like, he's a conservative person, and there are ways in which I have to be, like, I have to mediate his perspective on things and know that he is a prime example of someone who I've had to grow up with who doesn't think like me, and how do I talk to people who don't think like me, who will be glad to have Mayor Porter, glad to have the Prime Minister at a meeting, right?
Mm. Because, and I think, because I think part of it is, like, this notion in our parents' generations that Canada is the land of milk and honey.
Right.
And so I think, for me, the way that I've tried to navigate and mediate that, and doesn't always work, you know, is to touch and pick up on what the symbol of Harper and Rob Ford is that the generation that we're talking about wants to latch onto so much. So if it's about being able to have material security in our lives, making sure that our families are fed and housed and that our children can go to school and that they're not being picked up by the police going home because they don't look like they should be in that neighborhood, I think that's where we need to be able to interject, is to provide those things and show that Harper or Ford or Trudeau or anybody else doesn't have to be a part of that in order for it to happen. I think part of what white supremacy does is that, like we talked about it last week, I think a little bit, is that very moment of making you invisible and also hyper-visible. And so the ways in which we see ourselves are in conjunction with white supremacy. And I think that's when Grace Lee Boggs talks about this notion of shifting from, like, a reactionary way of engaging to visionary. So rather than only responding, we need to be able to also create ways of interacting with each other that are creative, and creative in the sense of I'm seeing you and you're seeing me through our lens, not through the lenses of white supremacy or Ford or Harper, you know?
Right.
But I hear you in making sure that we're able to have conversations with people and not just preaching to ourselves all the time.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of, in particular, this city is multiculturalism. I mean, we wouldn't be Toronto if it weren't for multiculturalism. And I think it is important to have those to build those bridges between, you know, certain communities, in particular when it comes to those who are oppressed by white supremacy. So, you know, indigenous communities, Caribbean
communities. But we're all oppressed by white supremacy.
That's true. But I mean, in particular, you know, indigenous communities, communities of color. And
black communities.
In particular, black communities. And, you know, because there are genocidal policies happening targeting indigenous people specifically, and then there are the unwritten policies that target black people, and then, you know, and then we've got like
folks
this sort of
color.
Folks of color, exactly, and LGBTQ, let's not you know, mm-hmm. forget that, you know, that community is also targeted by that form of oppression. So, you know, it is important for us to be able to have those cross conversations, and then how do we negotiate working and building solidarity with, you know, with colonial settlers? That's the question I'm constantly wrestling with. And also having, you know, having the mixed family that I come from, mm-hmm. where, you know, I have people in my family who identify a certain way and people who identify another way, depending on what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily depending on who they are or where they come from, but it really does come down to what you look like. For a lot of people, right, in terms of how their identity gets formed,
mm-hmm.
If they haven't done that work,
right.
So it's a complicated issue. But one thing that I was thinking about yesterday, we were on the island yesterday, and on the Toronto Island, there's this one place that feels really, really. It's very special, energy there. It's very old, and it's never been developed. Like, you know, it's never been paved over. Mm-hmm. It's never had houses built on it, this one place. And so you feel this really strong and ancient energy there. And, but you also, for me, I just had this moment of really feeling that history of multiculturalism, multinationalism, prior to, you know, European contact. This has been the meeting place. This has been the place where multinational, you know, multinations have met through trade routes and through. So it's very significant that Toronto has that history, I think. And
I think also being there yesterday was like being in front of the city, right?
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the whole skyline and like how crazy alien it looks. Like it was just like
that
it was
the moment.
From out of space, just dropped there, and then we're under the trees. You know what I mean? Just like, what is going on across the way over but there?
It's interesting, like the Multiculturalism Act was kind of thought up at the same time as the white paper, right?
Yeah.
Which was expressly designed to assimilate First Nations. Like, you don't have status, you're not going to have territory, you're going to become a Canadian. What's a Canadian? We don't know, but you're not going to have that, right? Like, that was kind of and so multiculturalism was in that same kind of mentality. It's like how we have this wave of immigration because they had changed immigration laws like, you know, 10 years before, like the early 60s, and they knew all these people were coming from non-European backgrounds. So it's like, how can we get these people to buy into this idea of Canadian, right? And so they've created this idea of multiculturalism. But the idea of, like, I always found it strange because we talked about, okay, Canada's such a multiculturalist place. I'm like, well, isn't the Caribbean multiculturalist?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you have every group of people from the world and other parts of the world as well. So it's kind of like just kind of like taking over this idea of any place you have people from different cultures or quote unquote races meeting, it's multiculturalism in this very particular way. And I came across this term, which, you know, I like, you know, they called it white multiculturalism.
Yeah, because
it's really
still a center.
It's still a center, right. Yeah. It kind of centralizes this particular group of people.
And
right?
Then everybody else is the other nations that are coming and welcome somehow, which then again totally erases the like indigenous sovereignty movement. And I think that's what the fundamental project of multiculturalism in Canada has been, is a way to completely undermine indigenous sovereignty, and then as a result sovereignty movements throughout the world as well, by saying, but look, we're inviting and we're open, but really what it's also saying is that we're the center, and then you have to adapt or interact with us continually. So you're still marginalized, you're still in ways having to justify your own existence in order for us to recognize you as part of this multinational project.
Yeah, so thanks for writing my thesis there. I'm just not going to hand it in now.
He stole it.
I'm really interested. I'm really interested, though, in the dialogue.
Part of my thesis around this.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm really interested in the dialogue around assimilation of you know, those multicultures who are also coming from colonial states. And so we see this a lot, and we've talked about it a lot, about the intergenerational internalized colonization that, you know, we're constantly chafing against as we do the work of decolonizing our own realities, right?
But I think assimilation is a lie for Black people, for people of color. It's, I mean, to the whole idea, like, what was that court case that, can't remember, where one of our prominent community members got pulled over by the police because he was racially profiled, right?
Oh, like, Clem Marshall.
Thank you. Yeah. I always think about his African name, mm-hmm. And I got confused. So Clem Marshall and some other people, like, they had this joint case, and it's like, these people have been living in this country for so long, right? Well-educated, articulate, and we're still having racial profiling, mm-hmm. right?
So, and even if they weren't quote-unquote well-educated and quote-unquote articulate.
But that's the assimilation lie, right? Like,
right.
You have to be a certain model minority to be Canadian, right?
And if you're Black, that already takes you out immediately.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I mean, even if you fit into a particular stereotype, I was going to give a particular description. I don't want any Vibe Collective to get hate mail. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Particular model minority.
Particular mm-hmm. model minority.
Which,
thank you.
If people are interested, people should really read Vijay Prashad's Karma of Brown Folk.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's a really great book and talks exactly about what it is. And people can send him letters.
Right.
I like it.
Yeah, but I don't know if the idea is to really actually assimilate people, or maybe over time on a schedule, but it's to prevent certain things from happening, you know, and prevent the development of certain types of capacities that don't fit the agenda at this particular time.
Right.
And as going back to the question as to why people might support a Stephen Harper or a Rob Ford, it's kind of like people like, quote unquote, like winners, you know, it's like whoever is in power, they're going to have friends, you know, like I remember watching the... Oh, and I wish my memory was working today. But there was the Harry Jerome documentary. And he was PC at a time where people were like, yo, what do you do? And he's like, we want things to happen for our community. These are the people who can make it happen. So we got to make friends with them. And that's kind of the mentality that some people have in terms of whoever's in power, you're going to have to relate to them in some capacity because they can provide these things that we all want. That's what we came here for. So if we're going to come here and then pretend like we don't, you know, want these things to happen, then what was the point of leaving?
I was having this conversation, like, somewhat similarly last night about Jay-Z. Like, there's ways...
Oh, our favorite celebrity.
I like how you stopped yourself.
I did. I was waiting.
Waiting for the reaction.
Waiting for the reaction. Like, I think there are ways in which we can make a decision to assimilate, but then at some point we have to, like, be responsible and say, okay, I made it. How am I going to bring people in if I'm going to make that decision, right? Like, if I'm going to, for lack of a better word, sell out, or what my community defines as selling out, what are the ways in which I'm giving back to my community to who have supported me to get to this point?
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's a responsibility that
he shows up. That's how he supports.
Yeah, it's charity.
Breathing's a privilege, and my presence is charity.
Yeah. Yeah. If he shows up, then you're good. Yeah. You've been taken care of by Jay-Z.
They hired the right person then, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do think Jay-Z probably does more than we give him credit for. You know, it's easy to, you know, but it's like that kind of, it's been this ongoing conversation, and given that this is 50 years since the March on Washington, a fit one is like, how do we negotiate this injustice? Do we infiltrate and then try to help people over? Or do we do our own thing and then whatever? Or who says that it's an either or proposition?
I think it's a diversity of tactics, right? But I think that there needs to be some sort of dialogue in our communities that is ongoing, that's overarching, so that we can, one, honor and respect that for a variety of different reasons people are going to engage and struggle in different ways, for reasons of safety, for reasons of survival, I may not be at the front lines of a protest, but I might be that person who sat there and wrote those press releases or made the food for people or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. I may need to wear a mask because I don't have status, and you may need to wear a mask in order to make sure that anonymity happens. Whatever it is, that there's a variety of different ways in which we engage in struggle. But I think that we need to be able to have conversations about the purpose of that struggle.
Yeah.
And I think Debi said it really beautifully in her new monodrama. And one of the questions that she asks of the audience, she says, how do you know what you're looking for? And how do you know when you found it? I think we don't ask each other enough of those questions, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's huge. That's mm-hmm. a huge question, because I think sometimes we say, you know, we're struggling for freedom, we're struggling for peace. But your definition of freedom may be fundamentally oppositional to my understanding of freedom. So when we're struggling and when we're moving through these struggles in our day-to-day lives, understanding that revolutions happen in every second that we interact with each other.
You know, just getting that message out there, and a really critical part of that, especially when you're looking at things like intersectionality, right, is to have the physical dialogue. Part of the Vibe Collective, but was unable to.
Dot Caribbean
Her Jam.